outrider, someone who rides in front of or alongside a procession as an escort, a lookout, a vanguard. The outrider is separate from, but in communication with, the mainstream, pushing the boundaries, exploring, and reporting back from the frontier. Welcome to the Outrider Podcast, an ongoing conversation from the fringes of the mainstream. Welcome to the Outrider Podcast. Hi, Jen Zuko. This is our summary episode of our first craft topic. You know, we talked about form and function with my thing, form and function with yours, and now we're kind of doing the summary thing, and we're kind of centering on this essay you sent over on shape.
Yes,
or at least
perfect.
This person's thing on shape. So we'll get to that here in a moment. Oh, by the way, the essay, and we'll put a link of it into the show, is called "Sure, Plot is Good, But Have You Tried Talking About Story Shape?" by Joseph Scapellato.
On LitHub.
So we'll get to that in a little bit.
Excellent.
Yes. Yeah, so what have you been reading since last we spoke?
Oh, shit. So I started my Foucault journey.
Yes.
I kind of quit my Foucault journey pretty soon in, because I
just decided to Foucault off.
Oh my God. Thank you. Yeah. I was just like, Foucault off. So, okay. So my whole plan, here was my plan, right? I had a Foucault journey plan.
Right.
It was begin with this biography of him, because that was going to be a much better place to start from than from his actual, like, largely, like, most, oh my God, your wine is literally poured to the brim.
Well, I told you I was going to finish off the bottle, and you saw me.
Yeah, I didn't see it was that. Okay, anyway.
Yeah, fuck it.
So.
I opened the bottle last night. I mean, that's just.
Awesome. No problem. I'm here for it.
You started with the Foucault and the biography.
So I had a plan. I was like, okay, I'm going to read the biography first, because that'll be a much better like place to start from than just like trying to plunge into his largely agree. Like, most humanities professors and academics agree that Foucault was largely incomprehensible.
Mm.
And like, you know, fascinating, but like also sort of like, yeah, we don't know what the fuck he's saying. So cool. So I'm going to start with this biography. Then I would move on to the notes that my partner Paul has taken on his work.
Right.
Then, after I read both of those things, then I would move on to actual Foucault, like first, like the primary source. Right.
Right.
So I start. It's widely agreed is one of the best biographies of Foucault, and I don't remember the author name. He's in the other room, and I can't go see him. But
that's okay.
I read through like a good portion of the beginning of the biography, and I was like, all right, look, douchebag. And I watched it, Paul. I was like, is it bad that I'm so bored with this guy's like privileged / everyone thought he was amazing / he was so obsessed with suicide his whole life. Like, is that bad of me to not be obsessed with that the way he was? Like, I'm so bored. I'm sure it was revolutionary at the time, but maybe it wasn't. I don't know. I was just like, okay, douchebag. I get it. It's cool. So did you write some cool shit? I guess that's my thing. So
right.
I have not moved on to the next thing, which is like, okay, so I read the first part of his biography. I'm like, I get it. I don't want to go on the entire journey. I get it. This guy is unhinged and a douchebag, and it's fine. So now I want to move on right now to... Is your actual work, is the actual thought that you put out into the world worth us giving you attention. So that's my next thing.
Okay.
So I did a valiant effort, and I was like going through his life story. I'm like, okay, got it. I think I got enough. So now I'm actually going to go to the primary source and be like, okay, so what is he actually like? What is his actual shit like? And should I care? But I have actually started. So Paul bought this box set of the John le Carré spy series. And I had not read any of them before. And I'm amazed that I haven't, because I loved the James Bond novels by Ian Fleming back in my like junior high days. And so like, he was like, oh, I loved these when I was a kid, so let's buy the box set. And so I've started to read Le Carré. And I started with the very first one. It's the whole like, thing about George Smiley, that spy character.
Right.
That we all know and love from Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, right? So I started at the beginning, and I'm going through, and it is fantastic.
Oh, it is? Cool.
Oh, it's fantastic. I love it. It's so good. And we're talking about formula. It's definitely very formula, but like, especially when I'm going through the different subjects of the class that I'm teaching. And I'm teaching a fiction writing class right now at DU for the grad students. And so like this past week, we've been going over setting. Well, not this week, but last week. We're going over setting, and this week we're going over POV. But last week we were over setting, and I was like, man, he uses setting so well. He's just like, he's able to make the London of the 60s such a character without having too many info dumps.
Right.
He doesn't do the whole like mystery, like murder mystery thing where you like have giant info dumps that are like super boring. But he has info dumps, but they're really well done. Like, it's actually quite well written, this shit. It's like, I'm really, really impressed. I didn't think. I thought it would just be like formulaic, kind of boring, kind of pulp stuff, which of course it is. But it's been thrilling so far. So I'm very happy. Okay. What are you reading?
What makes it seem formulaic? Is it the stuff you've read before this? Because he's one of the kind of the originators with Fleming of like the, you know, the spy novel genre.
Yeah, the thriller. Right. Yeah. Right? I don't know. Maybe so.
Because it's kind of like, you know, if you go back now and pick up Raymond Chandler, it's like, oh, I know where all this is going, what's going on, because everybody since Chandler has been using Chandler as a template for writing detective stories. Same thing with Dashiell Hammett, is that you kind of have to take a step back with Hammett and Chandler, and you have to go, these are the guys that originated the genre. So stuff for them.
No. I would say Conan Doyle.
Well, Conan Doyle did the mystery and kind of the cozy detective, but the hard-boiled detective stuff was Hammett.
I see, like the noir kind of thing.
Stuff was Chandler. A lot of the detective story cliches that we think of today, you know, this kind of the sardonic stuff. Wit and, you know, that was Hammett and Chandler.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of take a step back when you read Hammett and Chandler going, no. The stuff they were doing here was entirely original. When they did it. Whereas everybody who's kind of writing,
I don't know.
Well, it was wildly original for the time compared to other kind of detective stories. This wasn't Conan Doyle. This wasn't Sherlock Holmes. It wasn't Edgar Allan Poe's kind of mystery detective stories. These were something entirely American.
Very different. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
These were kind of like this almost modern incarnation of a Western. This was the lone cowboy going out and solving this crime. This was and of course the tone and the style and everything was very unique at that time. Now, of course, you go and just look at detective stuff and go, okay, you stole that from Chandler. You stole that from Hammett.
Sure.
You know?
And Le Carré really gives a flavor of 1960s England, like so much. It's not American. It's very like taut English thriller, which of course Fleming was doing the same, like a little bit earlier, but like, these are so much better written than the Fleming ones. I used to love the Fleming ones. I do still, just, you know, for emotional reasons. But like, oh my gosh, it's like this stuff is not only well written, but it's well constructed. I'm like, oh, this, these are actually like excellent.
Yeah. So he got started in the 60s and, you know, Fleming got started in the 50s, but you could not have had these guys writing these types of stories if you did not have the Cold War.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Right. So these guys are the kind of the originators of that, because that's where the conflict went. The conflict went away from adventure and war stories into spycraft with the advent of the Cold War.
Exactly. And you can get that from this characterization, like of this central spy character. He came out of the war. And now it's like, what the fuck do I do now? It's like this very, it's a very emotional kind of thing. No, it really is. It's
right.
It's really cool. It's like, he's trying to retire. I'm only through the first couple of books, so like no spoilers, but like he's trying very hard to retire. And he's just like, well, I don't even know what the fuck to do now. Like, I came out of the war and I have all these skills and I'm kind of using them now, but like, I'm like, what am I supposed to do? Like, it's just, it's this very beautiful, beautifully written setting in particular. Like, the setting is very vivid. And so that's been really, really super fun. So yeah. So how about you? What are you reading right now? Have you finished all of this stuff for the award?
Have I finished all the stuff for what?
For the award.
Oh yeah. That was done back in March.
Back in the spring. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. They've already released the list and everything. No, last month.
Okay.
I've been Sweet. Concentrating on short Japanese novels in translation.
Oh, that's right. You were saying that last time. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Excellent.
So I finished Weasels in the Attic by Hiroko Oyamada.
Nice.
And I finished Mist Ice Sandwich by Mako Kawakami.
Nice.
I am about to finish The Hole, also by Hiroko Oyamada.
Who are the translators?
So like Weasels in the Attic was translated by David Boyd.
Okay.
Don't know those names at all.
Nope.
Miss Ice Sandwich was translated by Louise Heal Kawai.
Cool.
And of course, The Hole, also by Hiroko Oyamada, which I'm about to finish, translated by David Boyd again.
Oh, cool.
And then I have on the wait list coming up, Makai Kashimada's Love at 6,000 Degrees.
Ooh, cool. Okay.
There are a couple of others that I have, you know, in the wings. I haven't bought yet. They've kind of been watching them on the shelf at Watermark.
Nice.
Trying to stick with the short ones. What are my findings?
Yeah. How are you being impressed by them?
Well, one, just because it's not... I always read translations with a bit of a question mark because, you know, how good is the translation? How accurate is that to, this is why I wish I were a polyglot and could, you know, pick up languages. I wish I could do.
I have translated and I've taught a translation class and I can tell you about how the process goes, but please go on.
But I wish I had like the linguistic gifts like a Hoshi Sato from Star Trek Enterprise or nice. Uhura or whatever, and be able to like pick up a language, you know, in a couple of days. Right.
Well, there's two ways to go about it. One is the first phase where you like try and just get the actual like literal meaning. But if you only translate it to a literal meaning,
it's going to be sloppy mess.
Work out very well. It sounds like shit.
I don't often pay much attention to the language in translations the way I would with someone natively writing in English, right? When I look at works in translation, what I'm often going for are the big items, right? What's the character development? What's the structure? Our form and function, you know?
Yeah.
How do they handle, you know, plot differently? How do they handle the story arc? How do they work with shape? Talking about our topic here a little bit. You know, because a lot of that is difficult to kind of fuck up, right? If a Japanese writer is writing a story that jumps back and forth in time and the translator does not jump back and forth in time with their translation, they've fucked up.
They fucked it up. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, that's kind of what I'm looking for here. And so mostly what I'm looking at here with a lot of these is just the brevity and the character development. And that's kind of what Japanese fiction really focuses on, is that internal character thing. So there, when you get into particularly the short Japanese novels and stuff like this that I've read, and even other Japanese novels and Chinese novels and Korean novels, because I like the Asian mode of mm-hmm. fiction, because it's not always so focused on we run over here and do this, and then we run over here and do this, and we run over here and do that. It's these subtle.
It's not on what happens next. It's on what the character is going through.
Right. And these weird interactions between people that have this, you know, subtle shift in the character's perceptions or views of the world, right? Because it's all very much internal, a lot of Japanese fiction. So that's kind of what I am really kind of interested in, is how these writers have developed and fleshed out and the nuances of the psychological arc of these characters.
Right, right.
And that drive for American, you know, Freitag triangle, you know, guns and action, and the American investment in high stakes tension just kind of sometimes pisses me off. Right? Because not everything that happens of importance is world shaking importance, right?
Yeah.
Your internal life, those tiny earthquakes of the soul are way more important.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what goes on in where a lot of the Japanese fiction that I like tends to go, more so than American fiction, is those little tiny tremors of the soul.
Totally, totally. Yeah, well, that makes total sense. Yeah, it's a lot subtler. It's a lot more internal.
But also kind of I drifted because I stumbled across a writer from England when I was wandering through the bookshelves, named Max Porter.
Oh, cool.
And I saw a couple of his later books, so I went out and special ordered his first book, and I've also been reading Grief is the Thing with Feathers by Max Porter.
Oh, I've heard of that one. I've heard of that one, actually.
And it's really good. So that's, I'm trying to finish that too, as well as the whole. That's what I've been reading.
Sweet. Excellent. What are you outputting?
What am I outputting? Well, still working on Crazy Unconscious Days. You know, slowly but surely. And, you know, that might come up more in our discussion of our essay.
Shape.
And shape. Yeah. Plugging away.
All right.
Slowly but surely. Some days I just tweak a sentence. Some days I write a sentence. Some days I write several pages.
Oh, wow. So totally varied.
That's how my process goes. That's why I sit down at the computer every single day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And don't hold myself to a word count or a page limit, because I'm there every day. Some days will be bad. Some days will be good. I'm going to fucking edit and chop it all up anyway.
That sounds like what this author is talking about too, where he's like, he feels like plot feels too much like summary, or it feels too much like outline. Just not how he rolls.
What are you working on?
Oh yeah. So I have just started a new series. I just finished republishing the Problematic Tropes both series on Substack. And so I'm about to start a new one. And I'm doing more original work just on Mondays. So it's gonna be Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. It's all gonna be original now.
Oh, cool. Right on.
Pretty much run out of old stuff. Although I keep going back to like old seeds. Like I'll go back to like an old like pen named blog, and I'll see something I wrote in 2017, which is like so poignant. And I'm just like, oh fuck, man, that's beautiful. I gotta put something around that, so I'll do that or something like that. But basically, I'm doing Popinations on Monday, which is all like what I call unhinged personal essays disguised as pub reviews.
Yep.
And so I'm going to continue that for the time being. Wednesdays is going to start to be Fight Clip Club.
What? Fight?
Which is
Clip Club?
Fight Clip Club. Oh, yeah, no, you're supposed to talk about it. the first rule of Fight Clip
Club. No, I was just making sure that I heard all the words correctly.
Yeah. The first rule about Fight Clip Club is please talk about Fight Clip Club. And that's going to start tomorrow, which whenever our listeners hear this, it's going to be irrelevant, but that's going to start on Wednesdays. And okay. Then Fridays is always going to be a vocab word still. So that's always right happening. And I just tweaked another version of my book proposal for the memoir. And I sent it out to a friend who is established. And so we'll see if she can throw it against whatever walls and make it stick.
Sure.
Herself. And I'm going to keep sending it out too. So it was good to have like an actual, like, because what I've been doing is I have a book proposal and I would tweak it and change it and make it like custom to various agencies. So I made one that's like not really custom to any agency. It's just like one that's just like, hey, here's the fucking thing. Right. So hopefully that'll be more useful for me too in the future.
Yeah. Any nibbles or sniffs? Any response? Anything?
I mean, besides like my friend who is established being like, hey, yeah, give me your book proposal, please. Like, that's a pretty good like thing. So I'm not going to tell you who she is because I don't want to like, you know,
right.
expose her too much or like, you know, make it too big of a thing. But
right.
That's a big thing. And I just sent one of my pieces out to another small little zine as well.
Oh, cool. Good, good.
My definition of postmodernism I just sent out to something. And so we'll see. So I'm starting to, you know, I'm still sending my big book out to different things. I'm still doing consistent Substack stuff and I'm starting to get more followers. I'm getting more big guys looking at me too, which is a good thing.
Oh, cool.
It's still kind of slow going, but we'll see.
Right on. Yep. I'm still holding to my 2 submissions a month. I got my first
great
August submission out last weekend.
Sweet.
But of course it's slow going and
it is
anxiety inducing, you know?
Yeah.
The thing about, you know, my old model, you know, which is 1 or 2 submissions every month, maybe,
right.
You know, it was that I was able to kind of like forget about it and not like constantly check, you know, the submittable page or whatever. But doing 2 a month, you know, you begin to realize like time. Right. Because there's that one submission that I sent out in January that is still in the we've received it phase and hasn't moved into the in progress phase.
Ugh.
And then there's the submission I sent out, you know, at the 1st of July, which almost immediately went into in progress, right? And then I have other submissions submitted between February and July that are in various stages, either, you know, we've received it, but haven't gotten into reading it yet. And others that like almost immediately went to in progress. And that was like in March. And it's like, you've been in progress since March. Come on!
Yeah, that's why I can't do submittable. I can't even look at submittable because you know, because the agents especially are just like, if we don't get back to you in a few months, just forget about us.
I fucking can't
that's
stand
like
that.
So much easier. That's so much easier for me though. I'm like, okay, fine. You haven't gotten back to me. That also sucks. You should give me a rejection letter. Like, give me a fucking rejection letter. Give me a bugger off and die letter, right? Like, give me that. But if you're not going to do that, fine. Like, at least I can be like, oh, you haven't gotten back to me for 2 months. Cool. I'm not going to think about you again. I'm not going to keep going back to your, like, to your thing and keep wondering. Like, I'm just going to, like, not wonder anymore. It's fine. It's good.
No, I don't know which one I don't like any of the submission things. I wish, you know...
None of it is really great right now.
Well, you know, and the thing is that it's moments like these where I think, you know, I wish I had an agent so I could just send them the manuscript and let them do all the stuff.
Let them do it. Yeah, right? Exactly.
But I can't get any traction at all. I can't get responses from agents.
Well, you're not getting responses from anybody.
Right. But here's the thing. I've been doing my 2 thing a month whatever for the small publishers. And I've gotten some rejections. I've gotten a really good rejection. I haven't gotten any acceptance yet, but here's the thing is that I get a fucking response.
You actually get a response. Yeah. You actually get a bugger off a die letter.
In the years since Evolution of Shadows came out, I've had 3 manuscripts now. I haven't bothered sending the Poison Moon off to agents. I haven't even bothered with them. The first 2 novels that I finished after Shadows, started off with agents. No response. A couple of form rejection letters, which, hey, great, cool, you sent me a rejection letter. But I cannot.
What about the people who published Evolution of Shadows?
That's a tough situation.
Oh, okay.
Small presses are always struggling. And
no, it's true. And but you got some good
and they
like,
have not,
attention.
They have not. Unbridled has kind of stopped.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They've stopped acquiring.
Yeah. Okay.
They still keep all of their titles in print. And
totally, but still
I think
common, yeah,
last year or something like that, they re-released a title that had been gone out of print by a writer who had passed away that they had worked with when they did a previous press. So they still do stuff like that. But as far as acquiring new manuscripts, they haven't been doing that for years.
I see. Okay. That makes sense.
I still have a good relationship with Fred and Greg. I still send Fred stuff every now and then.
Good.
Like, tell me what you think. Is it okay?
Oh, that's great.
And he's gracious enough to, comment on the stuff. So
that's not that you still have a good relationship with them. That's great. Okay, cool. Yeah, no, that totally makes sense.
So anyway, I'm in the wilderness. I've been in the wilderness for 15 years.
Yeah.
And this just shows you how, here's the way I've begun to think of it. In the last decade and a half, is that if I were the kind of writer who had a formula or had a shtick or could do a certain thing repeatedly and be content with just to explore the ideas but not tinker with. I hesitate to say this because it feels like it could be a criticism of writers that I do like, but who have had a lot more success, and I don't know why. And what that means, what I mean by that, don't know why, is that I don't know why they've had success and I haven't. Whereas I understand why they've had success alone.
Just because they're so good.
Right, because they're good, but they also tend to do things that are a bit more accessible, a bit more...
On Dacha?
No. I'm talking contemporaries. So like Laird Hunt, Emily Mandel, Peter Guy, Paul Stotonge, these people like this that are kind of in the same age group got published the first time about the same time that I did within a 5 or 6 year span, right? And have had multiple books published since then where I've had just the one.
Right.
For some reason, they're in a different loop. They're able to get things connected, whatever. They're able to produce a little bit faster. What we're talking about right now, their form and their function doesn't tend to vary that much. Now, the conceit, whatever, Emily Mandel has, she did a lot of contemporary stuff and then she jumps to Station 11, this post-apocalyptic thing. And then she kind of jumps back to contemporary. And then she has Sea of Tranquility, which is also kind of a futuristic thing, right? Whatever. So she's, but on from a form and structure type of thing, her stories don't deviate that much as far as their form.
Do yours?
Yeah. So when I say this, keep in mind that these people that I've mentioned so far, Emily and Peter, whatever, I think that they are in fact creating art literary art.
Oh yeah, no, it's good shit. Yeah.
But.
But you're wondering why there is and not yours.
They're painting, you know, the obvious. So if you compare them to painters, they're painting the obvious figure or something that makes people go, what? And stop. Right. And that's not me.
One of the short stories that is part of the material for my class right now in fiction. I don't remember the name or the author because I don't have it in front of me, but it has to do with a woman who travels to Cuba mourning her dead husband and then finds pretty much what she thinks is her husband alive in Cuba.
That was mentioned in our essay here.
Yes, that's one of the ones that's like...
Yeah, The Third Hotel by Laura Vandenberg.
Thank you. That's one of the, actually, coincidentally, it's weirdly one of the stories that are like, it's part of my material for my class right now. And I haven't read it, and I'm sure it's written very differently, but like, I don't know about formula versus theme. Let's talk about shape.
So lay it on me. What about this essay got you thinking about it and our topic here? Because I have some thoughts.
I would love to have your thoughts because I am a little... The reason I first shared this with you, because I was like, this author is... Okay, so the author is... What's his name?
His name is
Joseph Schiaparelli.
Scapoletto.
Wait, hang on.
Scapolato. We're probably horribly murdering that name and he will send us a nasty gram.
I think it's Scapolato. Yeah. Now that I see how it's spelled. So his whole thing is he's going with a sort of like meme structure, right? Where he's like, sex is great, but have you tried? So he's like, plot is great, but have you tried shape? And I was like, well, okay. But like, why is plot not shape? Like that was something I didn't understand. I was like, what, how come he's so confused? Cause to me, plot is shape. Like that's the same thing. So at the beginning, he was like, plot just seems to me, I'm totally paraphrasing in my own words, right? I'm not reading anything from the actual article, but he's just like, plot just seems so summary-y to me. Like it just seems like a summary thing or like a thing where I have to like outline my story and that's like not how I roll. And I'm like, oh, but that's fine. But that's not how everyone does plot. You don't have to outline your story in order to have a plot. Like, and he comes up with some examples of different shape. He's like, I don't want to think about plot because plot freaks me out. What I want to think about is shape. I'm like, well, how is that different? So I'm going through the article. I'm going, okay, so why is shape different than plot?
Yeah, how he doesn't do a good job of explaining that.
Well, he goes through a few different example shapes where he goes through different, like very popular shapes that he's seen in his own experience. He talks about, oh, there's a journey. It's like the fucking hero's journey again. We can never get away from it, which is fine. I like the hero's journey. I'm fine with it. Whatever. Hater's gonna hate. He talks about the Harry Potter series and how that shape is a school year. So each book is a school year, which is true. But to me, why is it not plot? But okay. And then he talks about like a haunting in another piece that he talks about. The shape like goes through a specific haunting. I'm like, well, that's not a shape. That's a time frame. Like if you go through like the beginning of the haunting through the end of the haunting, that's not necessarily shape. It's more like a chronology. Is that a shape though? So I wasn't really sure what. Okay, so he says plot is very summary to him. Shape is more useful to his process. He calls shape a structural container for a narrative. And I'm asking, why is that not plot? Because that's plot.
why doesn't that sentence read shape is a I have it highlighted in my notes here. Hold on a second. One moment.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Shape is a structural container for a plot.
Oh.
Right?
What he's, yeah.
Narrative. He right? says narrative, but I think...
He says narrative, but
it could just
easily
be plot. So, okay. So I'm glad you brought all of that up, the confusion, because it yes. tells me two things. That my interpretation was not wrong. And the other thing is that you and I have known each other way too long.
Yes.
Right. So I read this
plot?
About 3-4 times and took some notes.
Yeah.
So my first note was, it seems he might have started off writing something about plotters versus pantsers and then drifted into
versus...
craft. You haven't ever heard about this? A lot of YA and mid-school authors. So my friend, the writer, Brian Ferry, talks about this a lot. Or at least he talked about it when he came down to do a reading in Wichita with another YA writer whose name escapes me at the moment. But I have one of her books on my shelf and I should go find it and tell you who she is.
Okay.
But there's this thing that people often talk about, you know, called plotters versus pantsers. And these are people that sit down and they kind of plan out
the
arcs and the points and the beats of their story.
Sure.
Before they write it. And then there are the pantsers who kind of go by the seat of their pants. Pantsers.
Oh, I see.
And they just
tell the story and
they tell the story and they go back later.
As it goes along. Yeah, okay. And both things are totally valid, right?
Right. They're just different ways into the thing.
Yeah. Sure.
So he seems to be confusing formula and form and shape with plot as a series of events.
Right? I guess.
Because plot is a series of events.
No, but he's saying plot is summary.
Right.
And I don't
and,
I
and
agree
it
with
can,
that. I don't
it
think
can
that's true
be,
at all.
It can be summary if you take what he's... Because, okay, so here's the thing, is that for the first 2 or 3 paragraphs, I was kind of like going, okay, I get you. I understand where you're coming from. You have a problem with plot. You know,
with plot being like, yeah,
as a concept, because it feels like summary, because it feels like if you sit down before you've written the story and you try to plan out your plot, you are,
right.
as he says, you know, to come up with a summary of what I'm writing before I've written what I'm writing. And
right,
I've said
exactly.
that a lot
that's
before.
Not
I was like,
how he rolls.
And I was like, cool, I get you. I don't do that either, dude.
Many people write stories by doing that, but a lot of people don't, and that's not fine. So like, yeah, that works. That's totally cool. So then don't do that. So then just write out your story.
Right. So write your story. And yes, he's,
if you
keep it in that framework that he's a pantser and he just writes the story and then goes back later and revises it. Basically he shapes it. Because this was something that Bobby always talked about in our classes, that you go back in and you shape it.
Oh, I never
had
Bobby.
You go back, you write your draft. You just put everything in there, whatever it is you want.
Yes.
And then you go back later and then you shape it. You put into a shape.
Ray Bradbury, in his Zen and the Art of Writing, he says, with your first draft, your very first draft, burn the house down. Then later you go through the ashes and you rake through the ashes and you find, you know, you figure out what the good parts are of it and you shape it. Again, I'm using the word shape, but you go through it and you figure out what's the good parts of it. But you don't not burn the house down first. You have to do that first, right? You can't start with the shaping. You have to start with the insanity and then go back and shape it when you revise it. Yeah.
So back to my notes, he seems to be confusing formula and form and shape with plot as a series of events. And plot is a series of events that can be allowed to happen organically, growing out of a character's wants, desires, fantasies, you know,
tactics,
failures, roadblocks. So that's, you can allow that to grow organically out of that.
Yeah.
Or plot is a series of events that can be predetermined, i.e. by the writer outlining the sequence of events before writing the story. And I think he's confusing plot as just being that. and not a series of events. He is, for some reason, right. In his brain, and he says that very clearly in the essay, plot is an outline or a summary, and that's writing the story before you write it. What I find interesting, though, is that, you know, you get to the last paragraph of the essay, and it's like, if I were shaping this essay, I'd put that last paragraph first.
Right. So I'm like, so you're plotting it, right?
Because this whole essay isn't really about shape. It's about him explaining his vocabulary for understanding story.
Yeah, it seems like it. Can I read these four points of questions that he has about
plot
and shape? Can I read them out? Because that was something that really made me go.
We're not making any profit off of this, and so it's in the fair use realm.
We're just interested. One, what are some shapes that you see in your draft? What parts of shapes are already there? What whole shapes are already there? Two, what are some possible shapes that your draft is ripe for? What shapes could you organically add, pursue, or lead with? Three, what shapes are you perhaps resisting? What shapes are you ignoring because they don't match your initial idea for the work or because they'd be difficult to implement? And then four, what are the natural beginnings, middles, and endings suggested by these shapes? What exciting, surprising, or mysterious complications can you put into these positions? How can you subvert the expectations of these positions? This is all, okay, so these four points, mm-hmm. he's talking about, here are the shape-centered questions that I ask myself whenever I needed to rethink my drafts, have constructed, have demolished structures. So when he's revising, in other words, that's all plot. That's all plotting.
Right.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
That's literally that's how you plot.
Right. And one of my last things is that, you know, you can talk about having different vocabulary for understanding stuff, but it seems at times that he's misunderstanding entire concepts.
Yeah.
Right. Because I was reading the introduction to another.
There's
another book
plot
that I have on my to be read list that I didn't include today. It's called My Search for Warren Harding by Robert Plunkett. It's been out of print for years, and New Directions finally decided to republish it. And there's an interesting preface or foreword by one of the guys that kind of pushed to get this republished. And he talks about how there are books, if you're going to go out and try to do a certain thing with them, having a simple plot is really important, where your actions that drive the story are really simple. You have a character that wants one thing, and everything that happens in that story grows out of that want.
Yeah, it's my use of the three rules for actors that I wrote about protagonists.
But then again, you can also have a complex plot like Le Carré, who has these complex spy plots, right? Moving all these different actions and things that are impacting things. And the character that's focalizing all of that information does not understand all of them all at once and has to piece them together throughout the course of the story. That's a complex plot, right? So the thing is that you can have a simple plot and a complex shape. You can have a complex shape and a simple plot. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay.
So a lot of your detective stories and spy thrillers, they have a simple shape.
There's
a beginning,
a
middle,
plot,
and an end. You can plot it on a Freytag's triangle, but the plot is complex. The events that interact whatever and drive the story forward are incredibly complex and mysterious.
So what would be a complex plot? Wait.
So what
sorry. What would be the opposite?
What would be a simple plot and a complex
simple plot
shape?
And a complex shape? Yes.
Simple plot, complex shape. My books.
Simple plot, complex shape. Why? Because simple plot meaning let's go with Evolution of Shadows. Searching
these,
for a guy.
These three characters are go to Bosnia to search for their missing
figuring out
person
where the dude is. Yeah.
Right. And that's a simple plot. They meet in Sarajevo. They go on a trip. They go to the last place they see him. You know,
let's find him.
Find him. They don't find him. You know, right away. It's a simple plot. You're just going. It's a journey plot.
Okay.
Right.
But the shape
is complex because it deals with memory and the way memory intrudes on present action.
And relationships.
So the structure is complex because you're bouncing back and forth in time.
Yeah, yeah.
You're bouncing in and out of different consciousnesses. But
yep.
These people together, what initiates the plot of the story is them coming together in Bosnia to do the search. And
yes.
And their journey, their event goes from the little town where Emil is. They go to Sarajevo to pick up Jack. They go from Sarajevo to Srebrenica.
Right.
And then in Srebrenica, Leon's husband shows up and they haven't found anything, whatever. So they return to Sarajevo with no resolution. And while they're in Sarajevo getting ready to go back to their places.
Spoilers.
Well, it's been out for 15 years, right? And first of all, like I said, I don't believe in spoilers. I can tell you the plot of the story, but if I did my job as a writer,
you will still
read that story
because the
character's process of getting to that point is the thing that matters.
Absolutely.
Right? And that gives it its complex form.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's a really simple plot. They go from here to here to there. They don't find anything. They come back.
Well,
and
their goal is simple, right? It's just like, let's find this guy. When they find him.
That's your plot.
That's the end of the story. Yeah. But the shape of it is very complex. No, that's okay. You know what? That makes a lot of sense. Because I was like reading this whole article going, I don't know what the difference between shape and plot is. I don't think
he doesn't do a good job of explaining how he understands the difference.
But
he could have spent more time doing that.
Yeah.
That was a problem that he had with the whole thing. Like he kept putting naturally in quotation marks. And I go, but you don't define why that suddenly is a special term for you.
Didn't he say organically too?
Right.
At some point? Like, what does that even mean? With my recent articles about like authenticity and how poisonous that can be.
Now, he's got a collection of short stories out and he's got this novel, The Made Up Man. And I'm willing to... I have not read either, so I don't know how he works as an actual artist. But what's funny, I feel like we're doing what I was afraid we were going to do, which is like,
we're being curious. We're being curious is what we're doing. We're being curious.
But when he was doing his MFA at New Mexico State, he apparently studied with Antonia Nelson.
Yes, he did.
So I did my research when I was like, this essay confuses me. I don't understand what the difference is for him.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Because to me, plot and shape are different things.
The same. Oh, they're different things.
Oh, yeah,
to me, they're the same.
Because plot is a series of events.
Explain that to me.
Plot is a series of events. Shape is how you order those series of events. How you structure the overall experience of pursuing that plot.
Were you explaining that within the context of your novel plot and shape makes total sense to me. Like I understand that now. So everyone go out and read Evolution of Shadows so you can understand. It's actually really good.
And I do the same thing with the three novels that I've written since then.
Right.
Right. My plot for The Palace of Winds is follows basically the story of the Golden Fleece, of Jason and the Golden Fleece. That's the plot.
Right,
so he goes on a journey to reclaim his wealth, you know, whatever. The shape is actually tied very tightly to the plot because I'm making a comment because I'm trying to comment on the mythological hero's journey structure.
Sure.
And what happens when the structure, which in its pure state contains meaning. It's its vehicle and tenor joined, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the hero's journey works best. That standard hero's journey plot arc, the series of events, the call to action,
the cycle,
the journey out, the death, the finding of the boon, the returning to the living and bringing it back. That is a plot structure. And that structure works best when the metaphor that sustains it, the metaphor that makes it up, is conjoined and together, when the tenor and the vehicle are tightly bound together.
Right.
And the Palace of Winds actually is using that to start with, but trying to take a look at what happens when halfway through that story, vehicle and tenor break.
Ah.
Right? Where the vehicle continues following the outline of the hero's journey, but the tenor, the part of the metaphor that gives it meaning, disintegrates.
So is that a shape thing?
No, that's the shape and the plot match in the Palace of Winds. But what happens is that meaning, the tenor of the metaphor, collapses and disintegrates.
I see the meaning and the tone probably too.
Right, but the shape and the plot continue, but without meaning.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the whole point of that, the story. It's a story that's trying to illustrate this time that we're in right now, where our old mythologies have lost their meaning in the present day, where Campbell talks about us being in a time between functional mythologies. So when Bud in Palace of Winds encounters modernity in Los Angeles, meaning begins to dissolve and drift away, but he still follows the arc. As if it had meaning, right?
Yeah.
So the plot and the form have to be conjoined in that story. That's why I built that story that way.
Well, I noticed that, like, again, this author uses the term narrative structure. I'm like, okay, so what is that's plot, right? Like, isn't narrative structure plot?
Well, narrative structure is another term for form, right? Remember, plot is simply a series of events.
Yes.
Right? That's all plot is a series of events.
Series of events.
That's why, you know, back in graduate school, whatever, my thing was to say plot happens. Like shit happens.
Plot happens.
Plot happens.
Like shit happens. Plot happens.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the meaning and the shape that we put around those series of events that give it significance.
Plot happens, but the way we give it dramatic build, narrative significance, that's
shape.
Shape. Okay. Yes.
Because what you're doing with shape is you're taking the points of the plot, the events that happen, and placing them in an order or in a systematic way that highlights the meaning of those events in that moment.
Well, it gives them tension and all that stuff too.
When he's talking about your shape could be, you know, going to school. Yeah. Okay.
No.
That's a series of events. I got up one day. I went to school. I went to four classes. I came home. That's a plot. It's boring as fuck. It doesn't have any meaning.
A full year.
Right. Even if it's a full year. But that's still a plot. Now, whether or not anything significant happens during that school year, that arises out of shape.
That arises out of plot. See, okay, so here's how I think. Like, okay, so let's just take the academic year as an example. That to me is a shape. You have the beginning of the semester, which is like what, mid-August usually. You have the end of the year, which is usually like around the Christmas break or the winter break, right?
That's a shape. That's a series of events. That's a series of chronological events.
No, ergo, it isn't. It's just like a span of time. So, but if weird shit happens during that school year, like say you find the entrance to the Chamber of Secrets or like, I don't know, whatever your story is, to me, the academic year is just a shape. It's just, you start in mid-August and you end in mid-December. That's a time frame. So if
anything is not a shape, it's a boundary.
Sure. It's a framework. It's a frame to
right.
me.
And if, but right. All, it's a frame. All frames are rigid.
So they're going to be one shape. So if something weird happens during that school year, then that's the plot to me.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
But what that is, so you have to think about it from a kind of a structuralist standpoint.
I thought I was. Okay. Tell me how.
So within a structuralist standpoint, what you have is you have, particularly when you're dealing with a narrative, with a story, with an artificially constructed series of events, which mm-hmm. is what any fiction is,
yeah,
is that you have certain events that happen on a regular, consistent basis. I got up every morning. You wake up every morning and you do a certain regular routine. These are I'm probably going to misuse this word, iterative moments.
Yeah, but those are not the moments that
right.
you talk about
and
in
so,
the story.
And so what happens is when you have a moment, like you find the Chamber of Secrets, right? So think about it this way. You get up every morning. That's a tiny little pinpoint that happens every single day.
And you don't usually talk about that in a story.
And you don't usually talk about that in a story. You find the Chamber of Secrets. That's a big moment. That's a huge moment.
Yes.
So draw these out in circles. Draw them out in circles. So you're going to have a string of tiny little dots for every day you wake up. Then one day you're going to have a giant circle on that day because that's the day you find the Chamber of Secrets.
That
explosion,
like a pyramid,
that explosion of significance affects the shape of the story because that's what you're going to focalize on is the big moment.
Isn't that a plot point?
That is also a plot point.
Huh.
Right? So this is why his confusion about plot and shape baffles me.
Yeah, me too. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Because when you are quote unquote plotting a story, the plot points, the points that drive that story forward, the points that you would put on an outline or whatever, are those big moments that disrupt normal
makes
time.
Makes it a shape. But
that
that's
make
what
a shape.
It. Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And so...
Exactly. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Okay, thank you. So we... Yeah. Totally agreed.
So I kind of understand where he's coming from, but he's making a distinction without a difference.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And I don't understand it.
Thank you. That's exactly what my confusion was. He's making a distinction without a difference. That is
right.
Well put.
Because
yeah,
me,
exactly.
I make a distinction and a difference between it. Plot is a series of events. So what I'm focusing on with my plot are those moments that disrupt, that create the shape. Right.
So a plot is a sequence of events, and then that sequence of events makes a shape.
It can, yes. If your standard form is to always tell a linear story.
Well, doesn't a nonlinear story have a shape too?
If what your focus is on. Let me see if I can rephrase that. If what your focus is on is what the external things that impact the character is your focus. Right?
Okay.
Let's stick with the Harry Potter books, right? So finding the Chamber of Secrets, all the big things that disrupt the, that balloon the plot points that make the shape of Harry Potter. They work in conjunction with his character development. Now, let's backtrack into my stuff, where you have a very simple plot. Characters go from point A to point B looking for a person. That's it. That's all they're doing.
I mean, that's same in the other, but yeah, let's look at your example.
When your plot and your shape are meshed, like with the Harry Potter stuff, where the shape of the story is based on the series of events.
The sequence of events, yeah.
Right. The sequence of events is the shape. Where so what you have with Harry Potter is you have a simple shape and a complex plot.
No, it's not complex at all. It's aligned right with it.
You have a simple shape because it's a school
simple
year.
And simple. Yeah.
But you have a complex plot because there are lots of events that lead to that moment when he discovers the Chamber of Secrets that have not any direct relation to him. There are things that happened before he was alive. There are things that happened around his birth.
Yeah, yeah.
So this all of these things affect the plot and they get revealed later on. You know, Voldemort's plans are part of the plot and they existed in time and space before Harry Potter existed.
I see. So it's not exactly like the plot points. It's
so really, so think about it. Plot is a series of events, right? And the narrative begins at a point within those series of events where the author chooses to focus you.
Okay, so we would say that the plot points that happen before the plot points of the exact book are not plot points. They
are plot points. They are parts of the arc of a story.
I see. So the shape is that one academic year. But the plot encompasses many more plot points of very different. Okay, I see. Okay,
right.
That I can wrap my brain around that.
Right, because just like with your spy novels that you're talking about, that the plot, the series of events contained within the pages of that novel depend upon a series of events that existed prior to the first page of that narrative, and exist after the last page of that narrative. Same thing with the Harry Potter. Harry Potter's story.
But the shape is the investigation of that one particular
thing. The author has picked a character at a certain time and place to enter into that broad overarching plot, that broad overarching story. And he then has to make sense out of past, present, and future. And that creates all the tension.
If we're going with your work, let's just go with like Evolution of Shadows, for example. The shape then is this one particular investigation into what the fuck happened to this one guy. But the plot, it is like a speckling of all kinds of different time frames and everything else where we have to.
No.
No?
Mm-mm. No.
See, I'm still not getting shape and plot. I'm still not getting the difference, I guess.
Well, that's okay, because I don't think Joe is either. And I don't think I'm
right,
explaining
exactly.
Well.
I think I have gotten it and I've also lost it.
So we have to go back to the basic thing. Plot is a sequence of events.
Sequence of events. And so what I would like to do is conclude the conversation. I feel like I've gotten it before in our conversation, and I feel like I am now not getting it, but I don't want to loop. I'd like to not loop. So I feel like I've kind of gotten it and now I'm kind of not getting it. And so like, because this article is kind of confusing. So can we
reset, you mean?
Not reset, but like conclude. I feel like the article's confusing. B, I think that we understand the difference between plot and shape, and that maybe we don't agree in the same way that this author does in that distinction, or that maybe we don't have the same distinction, or that maybe there isn't one as much, or I don't know. I don't want to keep looping, in other words.
Right. I understand. I think what might have been leading to some of the confusion and the looping is something really simple, right? If plot is a series of events, then what you have to, then what, where shape comes in is adjudicating the scope of those series of events.
Oh, scope is a good word. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we trying to fucking bring Harry Potter into and compare that to discussions of my book is pointless, because the scope of the Harry Potter plot is much bigger than just the linear time frame from Harry Potter's first year at Hogwarts to his last.
Yeah.
Because right, it right. involves all of these machinations that happened before he was even born.
Right, right.
Before his parents were, in fact, even born. So that is a huge, that's a world plot. Then you could have personal plots. My book
is it shape or that's plot then?
That's scope.
Because that's a sequence of events.
Right. That's where you're, what sequence of events are you focusing on? Now, if I'd been trying to write a book about the Bosnian War, my scope would have been bigger.
That would be
bigger.
Huge.
But my scope of my plot was just the relationship between those three characters and Gray.
Yeah.
That was the scope of my plot. Was them trying to find him. It happened to take place in Bosnia. So a lot of that drifted into the story. But that story was that those things that drifted into the story, the history about Bosnia, were not relevant or pivotal to the plot.
They weren't plot points. They were exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's where I think we were getting, where we were drifting.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay.
Right. Is that who and what is the scope and the focus of the plot? And then you shape around that, which is how you order those events. You draw focus into or away from certain things related to that in order to highlight the things that are important. That's the shape that you give to a plot in order to make art.
Gotcha.
To draw the reader's attention to or away from certain things.
That makes a lot more sense. Yeah.
Good. Because,
because we've been talking for like more than an hour, so that's good that we have a conclusion.
I was talking to Delia a couple of weeks ago.
Hi, Delia.
And hey. I was kind of commiserating with her about some things I have around some issues that I feel around the podcast. And she was like, well, maybe you guys shouldn't drink when you do it.
We shouldn't drink?
Shouldn't drink.
What?
Yeah.
That would be so unlike us.
Right. But
the
also,
whole thing would just not be a thing.
But also, you know, considering the things that I was telling her that I was concerned about, she said, well, you know, if you're concerned about focus and clarity and all that stuff, maybe stop drinking so much when you do the podcast. I mean,
that's fair. But I think the point of this podcast is we're bringing other people into the point into our lives where we would in our grad school days used to get together and talk about literature, talk about our own literature and others that we were studying and craft stuff and have a few different pictures down on Gullah. It's like that I think that's kind of our kind of premise, isn't it?
yeah. And maybe what the thing is that all the stuff, all the form we've been trying to apply to this podcast is what's making me feel uncomfortable. That that's what this should actually, what we should actually be focusing on is a kind of a podcast recreation of what we used to do in the bar, which is drink a little bit.
Doing, right?
Right. But I've been trying to think of it as somewhere else. You know?
Oh, I see.
I've thought of it as something else. And what this really should be is just this window into two creatives. And these are the kind of conversations we would have on a regular basis. The kind of conversations
We would go out this is my whole thing. Like, this is why I think we're doing the podcast, because we used to go out for beers and we would talk about all this stuff. And we were brilliant. Of course, we solved all the world's problems, as all drunks do when they go out together, right?
Right.
Especially when they're in grad school.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. Yeah.
No, you're.
That's a good plot point.
I think you're right. I think my dissatisfaction at times has been because I kind of want it to feel like those professional literary podcasts that seem very important and talk about shit. And at the same time, what we're actually doing is we're just kind of putting out into the world a recreation of our rambly bar talks.
Why is that not professional?
I don't think we need to cling to professional or unprofessional. What I think we need to do is present a thing.
Yeah. Okay. So can I tell you about the podcasts that I listen to that are the most widely listened to, that have the most millions of followers?
Okay.
That have to do with talking about literature.
Okay.
And or media. Those guys, and they're most of the guys, sometimes girls, but usually guys. They're literally doing what we're doing. They are drinking and they're ranting and they're raving and they are going with their own knowledge of how things are structured. They're going through their own knowledge of what they like, what they don't like, and why. They're going through their own schooling, but they are literally doing what you and I used to do over pictures in the bars. And they're doing that. And that's the most millions of followers that I have, at least in my, you know, modest podcast consumption. The ones that are like, oh my God, I'm doing this I'm reading this thing for the first time and it's like amazing. And I'm like, I'll bring other people on. They're like, so.
Okay. Send me those shows. Like, send me links to those shows.
Okay. I'll send you one link. Like a couple of them are like people who are like very academically advanced. They're like very, very super, super educated, like PhDs, professors, and they're talking about certain.
So did you look up the bio of our essay?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so those people are the ones who are like, they will
having the super educated is not necessarily a marker of having your shit on point.
No, obviously. He doesn't know what the difference is between plot and shape. But my point is, if you're worried about us, I'm talking about us, like, let's bring it back to me, okay? Bringing it back to me. The podcasts that I have noticed that I like to listen to the most, even if I don't listen to them anymore, the ones that get the most millions of followers are the ones who are like, hey, we are two really, really fucking educated people. And we're going to get drunk and talk about shit together. And that's it.
Okay.
It's people who are looking for. Yeah.
So what you're telling me is, is don't be such an uptight shit.
Yes.
And just drink your wine and share your opinions about shit. Because I mean, I guess this would make sense because, like, I don't know how many times in graduate school I would make some offhanded comment in a crowd thing and it would come back to me like, oh, I hear Jason is like whatever. It's like, how the fuck am I like the person that I
used to go to classes drunk. Okay. Let's just put that out
right
there.
But I make some.
Not always.
There were at least two or three times, you know, when we were in graduate school, I made some flip comment about, you know, pre-20th century literature, and suddenly, like, people that were not in class, that I didn't have any classes with, would be like, come up and go like, so...
Seriously?
Why... Oh, I wish Jeffrey was still alive. He could tell that story.
Oh, Jeffrey. Oh,
because he was not in a class, and poor Jeffrey Goodwin walks up to me. I'm sitting outside at one point on Naropa. Jeffrey walks up on me.
Mr. Goodwin.
And I hadn't had any classes with him, and it's some other class. I'd made some comment
the best.
About, you know, pre-20th century literature, and I don't remember what's kind of snarky, you know, biting bullshit I had said, but he comes up to me and is like, so what's your what's your problem with you know, 19th century literature? And I was like, what? And he's like, I heard from
also,
this thing.
Whatever. Also, like, who are you?
Why the fuck is this getting around? You know, why is this the rumor about me? Right?
Because people are petty. Especially poets are petty. Oh, R.A.P. Fucking Jeff Goodwin. My good human. The Outrider podcast is recorded by Jason Quinn Malott and Jen Zuko. Audio is cleaned up and refined by Heather Ann Eden. Our show is hosted by Podbean.com.